Welcome to the podcast where relationships, confidence, and determination all converge into an amazing heartfelt experience. This is Speaking from the Heart.
Welcome back to episode number 104 of Speaking from the Heart. Today we have Robert Wolf joining us, and Robert is the founder and chief instructor of Eaton Dojo, which began martial arts training in 1975 and has taught since 1985. He holds black belt ranks in multiple martial arts and was awarded a Bachelor of Arts degree in Japanese Studies from Bucknell University, which is located in northern Pennsylvania, where my grandmother grew up, in 1978. The focus of Eaton Dojo is personal transformation through challenging training and practical skills. Mr. Wolf retired from federal civil service after a 40-plus year career with the U.S. Navy as a logistician. As Director of Maritime Industrial Support, he managed a department responsible for supporting the four naval shipyards with maintenance and modernization of nuclear submarines and aircraft carriers. A highlight of his career was receiving the Navy Meritorious Civilian Service Award, the third highest decoration possible for civilian employees of the Navy. As an author, Mr. Wolf has published numerous articles addressing the martial arts in a variety of periodicals, from popular magazines to academic journals. As a curiosity to myself, I've always been interested in the Japanese culture and the way in which it has interacted with the martial arts community as a whole. Martial arts go back several centuries, going back to even the empire that Japan had. And even then, what really is interesting about Robert and his overall story is that he took a dojo, which essentially is something that you normally think about in movies like The Karate Kid, as being this vicious, mean atmosphere, but really opened my eyes to the possibility that martial arts, particularly Japanese swordsmanship, can definitely create not just those best impacts in our different areas by focusing and concentration, but it helps us to grow and evolve in our personal and professional development. What I really love about our interview today isn't just about the fact that we have this structure that we can build to create opportunities, but that we can build upon the mental and physical focuses of our repetitiveness to be able to not only have better swordsmanship, but to go through the notions that we oftentimes usually forget about with not only improving ourselves, but becoming more self-aware of our surroundings and who we are. But with that, let's go to the episode. We're here with Robert Wolf. Robert, thanks for sharing your heart with us today.
Thank you, Joshua. I really appreciate the chance to speak with you.
I appreciate it as well. And I have to say, I have not had somebody from a dojo on my show yet. So you have that honor. So thank you so much for being able to share a little bit of your insights with us today. Robert, I noticed that you went to school at Bucknell University, which was very close to where my grandmother grew up. She grew up around the Sunbury, Shamokin Dam area in Pennsylvania. And I'm just curious, what led you, just to start off, what led you into actually studying Japanese at Bucknell? I'm really curious about the backstory.
The biggest influence is my father was a Marine during World War II in Korea. And he fought on Iwo Jima against the Japanese forces. And he always had a huge respect for the Japanese as warriors and opponents. And he also had the experiences of teaching jujutsu while he was in the Marine Corps. So somewhere along the line, just from knowing that, I had always had, as far back as I can remember, an interest in Japanese martial arts. I never had an opportunity to actually train until I got to college, but the original source would have been my father and his experiences.
Did your father mentor you and actually teach you this growing up?
Very little. A few things he had shown me, but not too much at all. He wasn't really interested in letting me do any kind of martial arts when I was younger. I'm not really sure why, but it didn't become an opportunity for me until later.
I find that sometimes either a father or mother shows you something and they want you to walk in your footsteps, or they don't and they want you to do something special in your career. And I've had a variety of different people on the show that have done that sort of thing to kind of create their own manifest destiny, as I like to call it. And speaking of that, you and I have something in common in which we have both been civil servants. I'm actually a state government employee for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And I noticed that you have had a rich career in federal employment. And I was wondering if you could tell the audience a little bit about what motivated you, knowing that you worked over 40 years with the U.S. Navy. I was wondering if that gave you some perspective in what you ultimately had started or had worked on at the dojo.
There were some things that I learned working for the government that I apply in managing my business, but the main advantage to me in having worked for the government was that it gave me more control over my personal life than a lot of careers do. If I had not had that control, I would not have been able to start the dojo when I did. There's always some opportunity that you have to do overtime and you have to do this or have to travel for work. But that was really a minimal impact overall. So I was very grateful for the opportunity to work where I did. I had a successful career with the Federal Civil Service. I worked, as you mentioned, for the Navy as a logistician. I'm not especially into blowing things up and hurting people. So
thank goodness.
I kind of focused in my career as to trying to help the people that were in the offices that I managed. I became a manager fairly early in my career and then always focused on trying to provide opportunities and help other people get ahead in their lives, more so than focusing on the military aspects per se.
Was that with the civilian population that you served, or was it with
Yes.
other individuals in the Navy itself? So those that were actually actively serving, did you help both of those? And if so, how did you actually do that?
It was a limited extent of helping active duty military in various positions that I had. I would have a military officer as a deputy to my director role. And I did try to help them sometimes with recommendations, with higher up authorities, consideration for various promotions or awards or things like that. Very limited opportunity to do that. But when I had an opportunity, I did act on it. Most of the time, it involved helping civilian employees with either job progression, advancement, recommendations for promotions to other positions. Those kinds of things were much more typical in what I was able to do.
What would you say was the most rewarding opportunity when you were doing that to help others that you can think of? And you don't have to mention their name, but I'm just curious of somebody that you made a big, strong impact on as a result of helping them get to where they are either yesterday or even today for that matter.
Well, this is going to sound kind of funny, but when the government created its newer retirement system, the old system was civil service retirement, and they brought in the federal employees retirement system. And there was a huge PR push to get people to switch from the old system into the new system. And I was a manager at that time, and everybody in my office was asking me, what should we do? What should we do? And I said, well, let's watch what Congress does, because those so-and-sos are not going to mess with themselves. And Congress stayed in the old system. And so we all stayed in the old system. And for the rest of my career, every time one of those people was ready to retire, they found me and thanked me for making that recommendation, because there's a reason they don't have the old system anymore, because it costs them too much money.
Yeah. And that's what happened even to me, for that matter. I thankfully did not get into a newer system that they have nowadays. I'm actually in an older system because of the start date of when that took effect. So I completely understand that, not only from federal aspect, from the state aspect as well, because I've had plenty of years working even out of the retirement system for the state of Pennsylvania to know better as well. So Robert, I noticed, and I even mentioned to the audience, that you had this award bestowed upon you at the highlight of your career, which is the Navy Meritorious Civilian Service Award, the third highest decoration. First off, congratulations on that, because that's a big deal for many people that have been able to do a lot of great service, especially for government. But when you received that award, tell me your thoughts and feelings about receiving that, because you seem to be this sort of person to me that is very humble about it and is just willing to do it for the common good. That's the impression I get, but maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong about that assumption.
Well, obviously, it was a huge honor. I only know a few people over my 40-year career that received that award. And it was awarded on the basis of the actions of my office in the last few years that I worked for the federal government. And it's realistically more of a reflection on what the office produced as a team than any individual action I did. I always try to focus on the individuals in the office and making things as good for them as I could, because I always believed that you're going to be in the office for 8 or 9 hours a day. Trying to make it as pleasant an experience as possible was going to result in higher productivity, more motivation, people going the extra mile on stuff. So that's what I focused on. And I was successful in building offices that had different focuses at different times, different aspects of the overall operation. But I followed the same kind of general approach in each of those instances. And that's what I was really recognized for in my career. I was not a technical expert on the things that my offices did, but I was expert in creating an office of experts that could get the job done.
That is so key, especially even nowadays, is it isn't just about me. It's about what everybody else is going to contribute and provide to continue that work that needs to be done, especially in public service. That is so important. I've had guests on this show that have been on a variety of different parts of government, whether it's the Patent Trademark Office, even those that have worked the beat as a reporter reporting on what's happened in Capitol Hill. And they have shared some of the same highlights, is that we all work together with not only the responsibilities and duties, but we have to be able to empower those people to do that. Which, speaking of empowerment, you started your dojo, and I think that in itself is a very unique experience. So first off, I think the obvious question is, why start a dojo? And when did you actually start it? Because you had this successful federal civilian career. I'm wondering how that kind of interplayed. When did you actually start that and how you got that all together? So for those that need a reminder, your dojo is located in Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania. So literally right up the road from where my office is. I was wondering if you could share a little bit about how you got started with that.
Okay. So as I mentioned, I started in karate when I was in college. And when I was home for the summers, I found a different style of karate was local that I would train in when I was home for the summers. And then I would train in the other style when I was at college. After graduating, I eventually started to train more regularly at the local dojo, and that was the Ishinryu Karate Club that was one of the oldest dojo in Pennsylvania that was founded by Ralph Lindquist back in the early 60s. Training in that, I then reached the stage of my first black belt and continued to train in that style of karate, which was a traditional Okinawan style. The group of people that were training eventually got into semi-professional kickboxing. And we had a lot of fun doing that. This was back during the PKA days when those kinds of matches were covered on ESPN and had a lot of attention. We actually had a fighter appear on ESPN fights. My wife and I worked the corner for that fight, so that was a lot of fun too.
Wow.
But this group of guys morphed more into this kickboxing. They wanted to kind of re-engineer most of the practices toward that. And I was resistant of that because I wanted really to maintain the more traditional aspects. Kickboxing is a lot of fun, but it's not a traditional martial art in that sense. It's focused on competition and winning, which is not necessarily the primary emphasis in traditional training. So as this developed, there were growing conflicts between what I was trying to maintain, because at that point, the chief instructor was kind of semi-retired from instructing and had passed on to me the responsibility for running the classes. So there was a bit of a tension in what was happening with trying to hold things traditional and other people wanting to go modern. And it eventually just reached a point where it wasn't viable to continue in that. My senior student and I and our wives were all training in karate at that time. That's how I met my wife at that dojo, which was meeting at the Harrisburg Central Branch Y. things just kind of reached ahead, and we decided it wasn't worth the stress of knowing that during class you're going to have to essentially defend yourself for real at some point because somebody's going to take a shot just to try to prove a point. So then in 1992, we left to start Itendojo. And another factor in that was a couple years prior to that, I had started to train in Japanese swordsmanship at a school in Washington, D.C. And that made a huge impact on me in a lot of ways. And ultimately, I wanted to be able to do things the way I thought they should be done. That's the bottom line. But I thought it was more valuable to other people as well to have the opportunity to train in a traditional way. So that's what kind of led to the founding of the dojo. When we founded the dojo, my senior student was part owner of a building in Camp Hill. Ironically, his boss had also trained in that same karate dojo in the early 60s, and he was not happy that we left that club. And at that time, the second floor of the building was just empty. It was nothing there, so it was available. And he said, okay, you can use the second floor for 2 weeks, and then you got to find something. So we were there for 7.5 years. And he eventually thought of the dojo as his dojo. This was Mr. William Campbell, who was the president of the food brokerage that had that building. And he would always eventually have any potential clients coming into the office would be taken up to the second floor to see the dojo. And it actually resulted in someone signing a contract with them because the guy was a karate black belt. And he was, oh yeah, anybody that has their own dojo, that's who I'm doing business with. So that's how the dojo got started.
Wow. That is actually pretty cool to hear in terms of how it all came about, because I think we all have these unique stories of, well, this is how it got started for me. And I think that for what you and your senior student were doing, I think that helped to accentuate not just what we traditionally hear about karate, but also what you have learned in Japanese swordsmanship. So I actually want to distinguish this right now, because I'm sure my listeners are thinking of these movies that have all this different mixed martial arts and different types of techniques, samurais and things of that nature. Tell us the real story, though, as to what you provide at the dojo that relates to these different skills that you teach your students, because I find it to be that we have a misconception of what that is, and I feel that you can set the record straight for us as to what you provide and how that's different from the movies.
Okay. Over time, we've had opportunity to train with some of the top people in the world in the older martial arts. The Japanese kind of distinguish between Koryu, or old school martial arts, that were up until the time of the samurai being disestablished, which really wasn't up until 1876. Prior to that, we would say, okay, the schools were Koryu. They were old traditions coming out of the Warring States period. After that, it's more Gendai Budo, which is the more modern things like Judo, Karate, Kyudo, more arts that have transitioned to focusing on personal development rather than on the defense of the clan and being able to kill other people. So that's the distinguishing thing. In swordsmanship, we had an opportunity to train with various people. Over the course of the dojo history, we've had like a number of black swan events that forced us to stop training with somebody and try to find another way to go. Through this all, one of the things I always talk about the dojo is we have found over time that the group training together is the most important thing. And the arts that we've trained in have changed over the years, but having the group supporting each other, having something worthwhile to do and pursue in this developmental context of what these arts provide is the most important thing. So as for swordsmanship now, we're training in Muso Jikiden Eishinryu. That means peerless, direct transmission, true faith style. It was founded about 450 years ago by a gentleman named Hayashizaki. Like a lot of people in that time frame, we're talking like mid-1500s to early 1600s, It's more mythology at this point than anything. A lot of the details of these individuals' lives are not well documented and have been embellished a lot over the years. But it was a real person, and he did, having spent some time at a particular shrine in Yamagata Prefecture, had some inspiration to start a new school of swordsmanship that focused on drawing the sword, going into an immediate action. So that is what Iaido is known for, drawing the sword into an initial cut or a block or something like that. It would have been developed for guarding against surprise attacks and things like that, whereas Kenjutsu is more of a style of swordsmanship that the swords are out, you know you're going to get in trouble, you might be going into a battle, you might be going into a duel, but the swords are out and the engagement happens from that point. So that's how the arts between Iaido and Kenjutsu, how those are differently structured and the kind of the focus. But it's fair to say that most traditional schools have elements of both. But what we're training in now is Ace Shinryu. We train under Nicholas Suino Sensei, who has a dojo in Ann Arbor, Michigan. He is essentially a Budo Renaissance man. I've known him for a long time, but didn't get to meet him in person until just a few years ago. And once we met, we were still involved in a different organization at that point. And I made a joke at the end of a seminar weekend that if our current organization ever blows up, I would probably apply to become his Japanese Martial Arts Center East. And that's exactly what happened. The organization blew up and we eventually started to train with Suino Sensei. And now we have moved into training with him in a style of jujutsu that his teachers have preserved as well. So the dojo is now functioning at a level it has never functioned in the past. And I'm very grateful for the opportunities that have been presented to us. And at some point we can talk a little bit about just what these arts do offer for people that are training in them.
Yeah, I actually had that thought as you were describing each of those techniques, which thank you. That actually made me learn a lot about it because there's definitely a deep respect of the arts and how they are coveted and used even in today's modern standard. But you said something that was even unique in itself too, that even if it blows up, I know that there's somebody I can count on. And I think that's important too, that this sort of framework, what we're trying to do, whether it is becoming the best version of ourselves, which is what I try to work on with the emotional, mental impacts, you are physically training in that, which has a effect in the emotional aspects of it as well.
Absolutely.
So that's actually what I want to ask you is, how do these arts help others? And I would love to hear your personal perspective because I know that you've been training in this, obviously, for over 30 years. So I'm wondering if it's had some positive effects for you, too, that you can share.
Yeah, I'm just shy of 50 years in these arts at this point.
Good point. I was thinking of only the business. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, because I was decades before that dojo was started. To take the example of Ace Shinryu, this style of Iaido that we're training in, a lot of the training is solo forms. And you're using a weapon called an Iaito, which is an alloy-bladed Japanese sword that cannot be sharpened, and that was developed after World War II. Originally, these arts were practiced with live swords, real steel, sharp, 3-foot butcher knives. And we have those in the dojo as well. But after the occupation forces took over in Japan and people were not allowed to be using real swords, in order to continue to train, they had to develop something that the occupation forces would accept. So they developed these alloy-bladed training weapons that are non-functional as a weapon, but they're really delightful to use for this style of training. They've put a huge amount of effort into the development of these swords. They're perfectly balanced. They're really, really pleasant to use. So a lot of the training is in solo forms, but there is also paired forms using wooden swords that are more interactive between two people so that you get an idea of the distancing and timing and things of how these would have actually been used. But especially when you're doing the solo forms that are the core of the art, it really comes down to structure in terms of physical structure. It ultimately is about the generation and application of power. But in order to do that, you have to have physical structure that's optimized for a particular purpose. So it's very defined in terms of what the ideal is. Now, the actual structure, individual to individual, may change a little bit just because of different body types and length of limbs and things like that. But the template does not change. What you're striving for is set. And that process of trying to manifest an idealized structure and movement pattern is very, very mental. It's obviously tremendous physical exercise, but it is very intense mental exercise because you have to understand and visualize the pattern that you're trying to achieve. And that kind of repetitive over years of time of configuring yourself in very specific ways carries over into a lot of other things that you do. It makes you generally more organized, more observant, more sensitive to your own body and what you feel. So there's all kinds of outcomes directly just from what would appear to be an overtly physical process.
I think people oftentimes just think of only the physical aspects, not the actual ramifications of the good things that come out of this. And to reiterate this question, it sounds like to me that you have been able to focus, you've been able to be more sensitive, you've been able to be more organized as a result of doing this. Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely. And you can also very strongly emphasize the fact that none of this stuff is easy. When people join the dojo, I tell them, look, I don't know what your backstory is. I don't know what you've been through in your life, but I'm willing to bet that undertaking this training is probably going to be one of the most difficult, if not the most difficult thing you've ever attempted to do. And as a corollary to that, I usually say, so whatever you think this is going to be, it isn't, and it's going to be a shock to the system. So promise yourself that you're going to get through 3 months at a minimum, no matter what. And at the end of 3 months, if you just don't like it, that's fine because it's not for everyone. But by that time, you have a fair assessment of what it's about and what it can do for you. And usually if people persist to that point, they're good to go and they will train for an extended period of time. One of the things that comes out of the training, because of the element of discomfort with it, whether it's the iaido or the jujutsu or any of the other traditional arts, you get used to dealing with discomfort, which then is hugely valuable, especially in an office environment, because so much of any given day, you're dealing with stuff that's not fun and doesn't make you feel great necessarily. But if you have a greater capacity for putting up with stuff in the pursuit of a larger goal, that pays off.
I can't stress that enough. And I was literally thinking about the fact that I could see how this has so many benefits, whether you are an office worker, whether you are on a factory production floor, or even a distribution center. It takes mental focus and clarity sometimes, even with the mundane that you might do. This is a lot more challenging than just doing those sort of things. It is something that it takes great discipline in doing, which I want to lead with this with the audience, Robert, because you mentioned this on your website, and I just want to read it to you just in case you need to have a reminder of what this says. But this is under somebody that is interested in being a member, which if you want to check out the website, I'll have it in the episode notes for the listeners. But you say that the arts are about becoming more than you were the day before, becoming more in ways that have the potential to affect in a very positive manner virtually every aspect of your life. The practical, effective self-defense skills you regain are almost a side benefit. So I find that statement to be so revolutionary because most people are thinking, well, I'm going to go learn how to defend myself. But you're saying, no, that isn't what this is about. I'm wondering if you can clarify for the audience what this truly is, if they would to take on any of the different styles of Japanese swordsmanship that you have mentioned here throughout the show today that would be helpful for people to reflect on, especially if they want to engage in such an activity.
I will preface it by saying that the ability to defend yourself is an aspect that you will gain in these arts, depending on how you train and what you train in. That is an outcome. And even in something as unlikely as swordsmanship, I know individuals who, as first responders, had to defend themselves using sword techniques against an armed attack because they had an implement in their hands. In one case, one of the aluminum flashlights that are about 2.5 feet long. Objects that are about the same size and shape as a sword, people have used them in self-defense. It's more likely in unarmed cases and whatnot, but that is an obvious outcome. The thing is, though, the process of gaining those skills is what transforms people because of the kinds of things you have to put yourself through in order to become proficient in those practical defensive skills. One of the most important things people learn is what's called ukemi, or receiving body. That's the skills needed to get down in one piece when somebody throws you. Because realistically, thank heavens, most people are not going to face a critical physical assault in their lives, but 100%, they're going to trip and fall. And being able to land in one piece is incredibly useful. I know that I've slipped on ice and fallen, but just get up and dust off because I fell happily, correctly. I know people that have fallen from a height or been thrown from a horse that were able to execute ukemi and get up and dust off. So that is one of the most important things that you can learn how to do. But we've spoken about some of the not so obvious outcomes mentally and emotionally. I would also say that in terms of jujutsu, when you are training in contact with another person, there's a high degree of sensitivity that has to be developed. And there also has to be considerable consideration for the other person. In most punching and kicking arts, you're not actually striking into somebody's body. If you're wearing protective equipment and things like that, people can spar with contact. But a lot of times, you're not really putting serious power into somebody else. In practicing jujutsu, though, you're practicing the actual technique that is, in some cases, designed to dislocate a joint or break something serious. And the way that you practice safely is to be sensitive to what you're doing and considerate of the other person and clearly aware of what you're doing and what the potential outcomes would be if you mess it up. So it's a form of intimacy in a sense that you are dependent on the other person to a large degree for your own safety because you're doing things in establishing the scenario, if you will, of where that technique would occur. You are, as the quote-unquote attacker, you're putting yourself in a vulnerable position. And purely for the sake of your partner being able to train, and that builds a camaraderie and a close relationship that is different than what's developed in a lot of other kind of physical activities and sports.
That's what makes your dojo, that makes what your career has been completely different from what other people I've had even on the show. I can think of the mental, the medical benefits of people on the show, even small business owners around where you are, Robert, that promote that and help that. And I think you're doing all those awesome things. Well, I'm going to give you the last few minutes here, Robert. I would love for you to talk about where people can reach out if they're interested in checking out the dojo, especially if they live in the South Central PA area, or maybe they just want to connect with you, get some more of this awesome insight that you provided today, and they have some questions about some of the techniques that you have discussed today. Can you give us some information of how we would be able to reach out to you? And I'll give you the last few minutes to do that.
Okay, well, the easiest way is through the dojo website. It's ittendojo.org. And there is a contact form right on the homepage. That's the easiest way to get in touch with me. My email addresses are listed on the website as well. There is a Facebook page. There's Instagram accounts. There's Twitter. We try to reach out across multiple avenues of social media. Just Googling Iten Dojo is going to find all kinds of references to us right off the bat.
I think that that is so important to be able to find that connection, that team, that group of people that are disciplined. They want to work on that discipline. And I have to comment on the fact, Robert, that you're doing something that I've had many different types of fitness people. We talked about Noah before the show, and Noah's mm-hmm. been on episode number 6 for those that are interested in checking out another fitness owner. But yours is not just about fitness. It's about growing educationally, mentally, with discipline, along with the physical benefits that go with it. And I feel like for that reason, you definitely are the Rise Sage, if I were to give you a nickname as it comes to that. I feel like I've learned so much today just from hearing this and imparting some of it. And you dispelled a lot of different things that I've had about some misconceptions overall about how this all works and how we can become better in those sort of things. And for all those reasons alone, Robert, I want to thank you so much for being on Speaking from the Heart. Thank you for sharing your heart with us today. It was really a privilege to have this great conversation. And congratulations on all the stuff that you've done throughout your life and continue to do. It's incredible work.
Well, thank you very much. And if I have just one last word, I would dispel another fear that people have. The membership of the dojo is incredibly diverse. It's everywhere from mid-teens to mid-70s. Many people that have never done anything athletic in their lives, including women that have never done sports or anything else. The dojo is a very welcoming environment. It's surprisingly so to many people. I've heard multiple people after they started to train say, I can't believe how friendly everybody is and how much fun this is and how welcoming. But I mentioned earlier that martial arts are not for everyone in the sense that some people just don't care for it, but they are for everyone. Anybody can take advantage of martial arts training, and the only real qualification you need to get to be a black belt is pure stubbornness.
There, that's a line to end with. Be stubborn and you'll be able to grow in many different ways, and even with people that are like-minded and in an environment that is open and friendly. So I love that. Thanks again, Robert. Really appreciate you having on the show.
Thank you, Joshua.
I want to thank Robert again for the opportunity to interview him, and I encourage anybody that's in the Mechanicsburg area to check out Eaton Dojo, because it is certainly an experience unlike any other. And I had told Robert even afterwards that I would be interested in interacting in one of his classes that would allow visitors to be able to participate and see what this is all about. But I really am left with this big overarching question to start out. Who motivates you in what you have become? Robert and I have certainly some interesting interplays between our federal and state civil service careers. Whether it's really related or not is a whole other discussion in itself. But really what I find interesting about what he's been able to do is that he's taken his 40 plus years while doing the dojo and has been helping others through a variety of different instructors, let alone senseis for that matter, to be able to provide a different array of best recommendations and best practices to the students that go through that program. All kinds of different types of swordsmanship in itself is something that you normally don't think about in South Central Pennsylvania, let alone maybe even in the cultural sense of what we've been able to fantasize about, even in movies, television, and other sort of mediums. Yes, I mentioned earlier in the beginning of this episode about the Karate Kid. Mr. Miyagi and even Danielson, for that matter, have been always inspirations for me, and even into the recent adaptation of Cobra Kai that was featured originally on YouTube and then was premiered onto Netflix. But it isn't what we are talking about here today. And by all means, I don't think I want to give any disrespect to the fact that Mr. Wolf, let alone his team, have provided a team-oriented atmosphere that creates self-discipline, self-acknowledgement, but focus. Because when we produce that focus, whether we connect it with all the pieces of our separate lives into one atmosphere where we discipline ourselves to stay on track, especially with handling a weapon that can cause severe injuries, it can create such a big difference in life or death. And I certainly don't want to be on the receiving end of somebody that was not paying attention and was carelessly swinging their sword around. But I think that we have that happen to us every single day. No, we're not carrying swords, and we're not usually carrying weapons for that matter, which unfortunately has become such an epidemic in America, and parts of the overall world. But I think that we need to start to take a big step back and start thinking about what are the things that actually make us swing our swords. Usually we're swinging words around, whether we are on social media, whether we're face-to-face with someone that has aggravated us, or we're just overly frustrated and we just want to get something out of our minds. But is that really being focused? Is that really being disciplined? And as a matter of fact, is that really a good technique to be using, especially when you're trying to work through all kinds of different issues? The art of personal development, which I specialize in, is essentially the growth that we can have through our self-worth by not only identifying what we have inside of ourselves, but also around us. And I think that Robert's Dojo essentially creates that opportunity in group settings to do exactly what I do on an individual and sometimes team basis. Having that peerless, direct translation of faith allows us to create techniques that we're trying to create and grow in, which is essentially who we're trying to look at, which thus goes back to my original question, who are we looking up to? But when we practice and we create that interaction with others, especially with what Robert provides in this atmosphere that is seriously of vast interest, can allow us to focus, grow, and gain strength in ways in which we might not otherwise gain strength in Western culture. The Eastern culture, especially with the Chinese, the Hindus, and all kinds of other sects and religions, have really focused on the fact that if we have meditation and focus in our lives, and we pray carefully about these sort of instances, we can certainly make a big difference in our lives. Now, I'm not advocating for you today to pick up Japanese swordsmanship and start swinging a sword around, because that's not what this is all about. And if you're a first-time visitor to the show, you will always hear me say that it isn't about stuffing religion down someone's throat or even advocating or forcing somebody to do something that they don't want to do or they feel quite uncomfortable with. I've had that happen to me time and time again in my life, and I certainly would not want that to happen to somebody else. But if we think about the application of power, the power in which we might focus through a sword or some other blunt instrument, and we start swinging it around, obviously the reaction, especially if we're around human beings, or even friends or family members for that matter, will certainly be quite concerned about why we're swinging something around. But isn't that what we're doing if we use poor word choice? Or if we don't even consider the fact that other people that are going through some of these situations that we are struggling with might not feel quite comfortable being able to discuss or even relate to us. As a matter of fact, not only are we hurting them, we're repelling them. Mental and physical focus with repetitiveness by configuring not only the organization, the sensitivity, but also the focus that we provide can help us create those aspects of our lives to be much better in the overall grand scheme. But we have to be aware of what we're doing. If we're doing it carelessly and we're not paying attention, we certainly are going to hurt somebody. But I think what makes this really important is that we have to be practical. We have to give ourselves that ability to receive in the body and get it all together by being able to understand that every time that we make a choice, it's either for or against. I don't know if I have ever shared with you the importance of why this is really harsh in nature to not pay attention to what is happening around you, but I think back of the times in which I was really struggling with my autism. And no, I didn't have that idea of what was going on in my life from a young age because, as I mentioned in previous episodes, my autism diagnosis came quite late in life. But as I think about the fact that when I ran out of classrooms acting out and not appreciating what teachers and even the principal for that matter had to endure, I was using a negative force that was not focused. It was unbalanced. It was creating disruptions not only for myself, but for others around me. It was later told to me that when I ran out of classrooms sometimes, I was actually smacking people, and I don't even remember doing that. Apparently, I hurt a girl so badly when I had one of my episodes that it really scared her, and she never wanted to talk to me. Now, later on in life, I was able to make amends, and we actually had a good friendship. And sometimes, we have to go through some of those trials and those tribulations to really learn that we need to be careful about what we're saying or even doing, for that matter. And as a child, that's why discipline becomes so important. And I'm not advocating that you smack your child, because that's not something that I would really recommend. Other people in the old days would certainly say that, yes, corporal punishment is the way to go. But I'm not even advocating for or against. As a matter of fact, here at Speaking from the Heart, I really want to condone any sort of violence, because violence in itself is not the answer. And even Robert's discipline at his dojo is not about violence. It's really providing a different alternative to the overall world that we live in. And how we start to address that, just like how we start to address a goal that we have in mind, means actually being focused. If you are unfocused and you're not quite sure how to best move forward, maybe doing a different type of activity, such as Japanese swordsmanship, might be the way to go. Now, maybe that dojo is not close to you, and you might not have the resources or the opportunity to participate in quite an experience just like what Robert's dojo does provide. But I think that it's not just about what we are able to provide to ourselves, and it's not just about what other people provide to us, which I've always advocated in previous episodes. If we want to have that inward peace and that focus to be able to become something that we never thought possible, it does take a lot of discipline. But it doesn't mean that you have a license to hurt other people like James Bond does in many of the movies that have also been televised. It doesn't mean that you have to be the Cobra Kai and beat the crap out of every single type of person that stands in your way. When you think about the fact that when you are disciplined, you're learning so much more about who you are and what you want to become. It also means that you have that direct translation of faith into the techniques that you want to create, not just for yourself, but what you will embody for the rest of your life. One big thing about Robert's story that we haven't even covered yet is the fact that he served 40 years in the military, more specifically, the U.S. Navy. I think that experience certainly translates into the bigger opportunities that we can all have, because if we live a disciplined life, even if it's not with the United States Navy, or maybe it's with some other type of organization in which helps us to build our character and build the relationships and all the opportunities that we have for who we are as a person individually, I think that can make such a big difference, not just in the ways in which we swing our swords, let alone swing our experience and our words around, but helps us to stay organized, makes us sensitive to what other people have to say, and remain focused on the overall goal or mission that we're setting out to do. So don't go through the same notions as everybody else. Don't swing your swords around thinking that you're going to make a big difference by threatening others with force. You have to be aware of what you're doing. Not only does it help you create that opportunity for yourself, not only does it help you with getting best recommendations or best practices, but I think that leading that sort of life where you can meditate and focus on what the bigger picture is can help motivate you on not just what you should become, but also help you create that impact that you always wanted to make. And even with that sword that you might be utilizing, just put it away. Knowing the skill is more important than actually using it. Because even as what Danielson was taught by Mr. Miyagi in The Karate Kid, it's not just about what you are utilizing, but it's about what you're learning that you can pass along to others. And I think learning is such a lifelong gift to give instead of just hurting others. Pain is not the ultimate reward. Pain does not exist in your dojo, and neither should it exist anywhere in this world. Thanks for listening to episode number 104 of Speaking from the Heart, and I look forward to hearing from your heart very soon.
Thanks for listening. For more information about our podcast and future shows, search for Speaking from the Heart to subscribe and be notified wherever you listen to your podcasts. Visit us at www.yourspeakingvoice.biz for more information about potential services that can help you create the best version of yourself. See you next time.